line in that transmission line. The probe on my slotted line has no directional characteristics. It mixes together the forward flowing signal and the reverse flowing signal. Therefore, as I move that probe on the slotted line, I will see peaks and valleys, and it looks like the signals are mixing. But the mixing only took place inside of the probe of my slotted line. If I used directional couplers, like a Berg wattmeter, and I use the slug in the forward manner, it measures the forward signal. Let me drop. And I flip the slug around, and in the reverse direction, I measure the reverse signal. And therefore, directly, I measure forward and reverse signal. I go to a chart, and with my Berg wattmeter and those two measurements, I know the standing wave ratio. It's based on the assumption that those signals do not mix, even though they pass through the exact same chunk of medium at the exact same instant of time. Now, only when I've got some kind of a dichroic material, something that is non-isotropic in its refractive index or other kinds of nonlinearity, when I go through a crazy crystal, yes, I can get my photons to interact in various ways. I get all kinds of crazy effects. The frequency doubling crystal that's on my green laser pointer, for instance, will take infrared energy and put out the second harmonic of green. That's a nonlinear material. So their interaction of crazy kinds of the photons is taking place. But in a thoroughly linear medium, like free space, I say those photons pass through each other with no interaction of any kind. And you may disagree with that. Therefore, I'm going to give you an opportunity. At 2NNU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, well, you really have to read about that, because this is really a complex matter. But it gets to the nuts and bolts of polarization. Riemann spirits dealing with orientation reversal of planes. That has to maintain a constant orientation in the sphere. So, as such, the planes are becoming holomorphic, or sometimes diferomorphic. So they explain all that, but you have to go to the nut of it. So what will happen there with the photons or whatnot, it's written down in the mat. What deals with the traversing of planes from one polarization to another is what is called diferomorphism. Oh, I have problems with that. I wrote it down. Diferomorphism of wave plane when one is translating to another because of the field's reversals. And that is quite complex, but it's all out there for those that want to know. Let me put it this way, Dick. Back to you.
Now, when it comes to radio astronomy, the radio astronomers are able to measure local strength of a magnetic field in the vicinity of a star system by, I think it's called the Riemann effect, but I'm not sure now. If there is a local...
2 meter, transmit.
If there is a local plasma material with a local magnetic field, it will favor certain polarizations. So by doing a polarimetry experiment with your radio telescope, even though you might be 1,000 light years away from a particular star system, you can measure quantitatively what is the local magnetic field if you properly analyze the polarization, polarimetry, of the signals you receive from various points in space in the vicinity of that star system you're studying. That may be called the Riemann effect. I forgot what's the name of that effect right now. I attended a lecture on that subject at National Radio Astronomy Observatory about 10 or 12 years ago by one of the guys that was doing the work. Fascinating stuff. He was also discussing with us the fact that while he was following his contract to do the measurement that he was funded to do, he was simultaneously gathering all that information and reprocessing the data to see whether or not there was any extraterrestrial intelligence involved, which he didn't get approval to run that particular experiment, but if he takes the data that he measured during the experiment that was approved and reprocesses that data on his own time, looking for an ET signal, that was one of his experiments. It was a fun thing to listen to about. And the big QSO in the sky. One of these days we're gonna see some evidence of that. You wait and see. If you think we're alone in this universe, you'd have to be kind of arrogant to think that life only formed in one particular planet, on one particular solar system, in one particular galaxy, one particular galactic group, in one particular universe. You have to be pretty arrogant to think that we're the only ones, because there's ample evidence that life as we know it appears to be spontaneous. Thought of with the right raw materials, wait long enough, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory, and the forming of the basic building blocks of life, the amino acids, that'll happen every time in a test tube when you do the experiment the right way. And in theory, if you wait long enough, life will crawl out of that test tube. That's what Stanley Miller approved way back in the 50s. Okay, I think we've answered the two guys who said they had questions when they signed in. But you wait. Some of these guys that are listening to all this jazz, I've got some... And I think Mel said he's got...
Repeater, time out.
I better go over to Mel first. Mel, I think you said you had some further comments on some of the above. K2KEY, KQLIW.
WB2HWW, with a comment, please, Dick, on the subject.
Okay, how we recognize. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Well, basically, the only comment I'm going to say that, as you said, we really encourage amateur radio operators to experiment with one place that is easily, that they don't have to have a lot of sophisticated equipment at all, it's like you said, with antennas. So that's the bottom line. A lot of people have questioned me. They do ask me similar questions on the 10-meter net. And the idea is that you don't have to be afraid of doing antenna experiments. That's the bottom line. Okay, go ahead, pick up Howie. We did have a nice QSO with Howie, by the way, on his repeater this afternoon, Dick. Go ahead, please.
You got it, Howie.
I was going to make a comment, Dick. You talk about two signals. If they're in a nonlinear, if they're in a linear device or in a linear environment, there's going to be no effect, because if they had an effect or they did any kind of mixing, you would have two signals. You would have interference all over the place. The only place, you know that, where you're going to get a nonlinear effect is in a device that's running in a nonlinear region, such as a mixer. You know, you take two signals, you put them together, you're going to get the sum and the difference. And the only place where you're going to get that kind of mixing is in a nonlinear device, as if it be, something that's oxidized and you have some kind of rectification. But if you put two signals in a vacuum, they're not going to have any effect on each other. One could be on one channel, one could be on another frequency. That's how you're able to send all these radio waves through the air. Normally they don't have effect on each other. The only time they have an effect is when they excite or they go into a nonlinear device or region. Over to you, Dick. I hope I made that simplified.
Yes, you did, Howie. And one of the first guys who ever used nonlinear devices on a radio signal is a man in 1890, I think it was, Subramanian Bose, B-O-S-E, an electronic engineer from India who was educated in the United Kingdom, some of his education, his techno education, and he did a whole lot of experiments at 60 gigahertz with spark gap transmitters. You Google the word Bose and IEEE, and you'll find a beautiful set of pictures of the experiments he did in roughly 1890 at 60 gigahertz. And his nonlinear device was a sharp point of piece of galvanized steel going into another sheet of galvanized steel right across a spark gap, and that was a kind of a rectifier, the early equivalent of a cat's whisker, if you know what I mean. And he got rectification out of that, and nonlinear effects and frequency multiplication and so on. He took the railroad cables from India and put sheets of tinfoil between the pages and twisted the railroad table, and he was able to twist polarization. He could send a vertical signal into one end of this device, and out of the other end he could get a horizontal signal. So he was doing all kinds of directivity experiments, antenna gain experiments, signal generating experiments. You ask the average electronic engineer who did work first at 60 gigahertz, and they will tell you, I guess it was a Bell Lab engineer roughly 1970. Somebody did it 80 years sooner. In India, of all places. It's kind of surprising. So radio has had some very peculiar fits and starts. the crystal detector, solid state electronics. We had the ability to do that a lot earlier than we really did invent the transistor. A person who had a Galena crystal with a cat's whisker on his crystal set radio, had he plugged two cat's whiskers into that Galena crystal at the same time and properly biased them, there is a chance he could have made a transistor. And some of the experiments that were done by various people way back in the dark ages of radio in the early portion of the 20th century could have run into some of these experiments. The code
repeater, timeout.
The thing that was their radio receiver in those days, the so-called coherer, which was really a glass tube with a bunch of iron filings inside of it and two contacts on the ends, that was the detector. And how in the world they got any sensitivity out of that thing is amazing to me. Compared to a modern-day radio, wow, they could have had a lot more range of their radios if they had the right equipment. It's just a matter of developing the equipment. And radio engineers run into a very peculiar characteristic. At every point in time, no matter what frequency is then being used as a popular transmitting and receiving frequency, the people doing the work at the time will say that, well, the next decade of pirate frequency is useless. We'll give it to the ham radio operators, let them tinker around with it. To the guys who are using broadcast at roughly 1 megacycle, the medium frequencies, the high frequencies at 3 to 30 megacycles looked like they were useless until the ham started making real long communication with ionospheric reflection. And so above 30 megacycles was considered useless until the ham started using 6 meters and 2 meters and 70 centimeters and making long-range contacts. That whole process keeps getting repeated over and over again. Right now, the hams that are on 10 gigs think that the frequencies above 10 gigs are useless. Well, I talk to people who are doing experiments at 78 gigs and 241 gigs and 405 gigahertz, and they're making QSOs. And it's very useful up there. You get a whole lot of gain out of a very small amount of antenna. I will admit you get rain attenuation and atmospheric absorption due to moisture. But as you go even higher in frequency, even that disappears. Obviously, on a clear day, the optical frequencies get through the atmosphere very well. So when you plot the holes of transmissivity, let me drop. Okay, I heard a signal. Somebody sign in. I'll stand by in a minute and find out who that was. When you plot the individual frequency regions where the atmosphere is partially transparent, partially absorptive, and then re-transparent again as you go up to higher and higher frequencies, it's all the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. You start off at DC, and you go all the way up to low frequency, medium frequency, high frequency, VHF, UHF, SHF, EHF, millimeter, sub-millimeter, terahertz, multi-terahertz, ultra-long-range infrared, medium-infrared, near-infrared, optical, ultraviolet, near-ultraviolet, far-ultraviolet, X-ray, cosmic ray. It's all the exact same spectrum. All you've done is change the frequency or wavelength, no matter which way you want to look at it. And a sound wave... that's being used by a ultrasound machine that's giving you a three-dimensional picture of what's going on inside your body has a strong similarity to the radio signal radiated by a phased array antenna into free space to talk to a satellite. There's a strong similarity between those two, even though the frequencies being used are very, very different. Okay, somebody else wanted to sign in. We're going to let the machine drop long enough to let people sign in. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, you should once speak about VSAT. That might be very interesting.
Dick, I want to make a couple more comments on this subject.
W2OS, so I have another subject, Dick.
N2RDB, just supporting the net.
V2RY Joe, what question? Checking in.
Okay, OSR and Joe, Bob and Joe both had a question. But there was another person trying to sign in earlier. We're going to wait long enough for the machine to drop so that people on the internet, if that's where they are, or IRLP or Echo Link, can sign in. We're going to let the machine drop.
Dick, I'd like to make another comment here before I get out of here.
Hey, I just heard Doug. Long time no hear, Doug, W-A-T-U-S-A-Y, who's coming in either by Echo Link or IRLP or whatever. We're going to get to you in a second, Doug. Go ahead, Howie, with your comment.
When you talk about transistors, you go back to the 30s to Schottky's. Schottky did a lot of work. You remember the Schottky curves? And that's all I wanted to make, that if you go back to the date. Now, how did they know that in 1889 he was experimenting at 60 gigs? Is that done by the measuring the wavelength of the sparks? I'm curious.
Yeah, he was using crystals to focus. He was doing the equivalent of spectrum separation by way of a prism. He was measuring wavelengths. He was measuring directivity, measuring antenna patterns, measuring polarization. He was a very smart guy, this guy Bose. So when you Google the word Bose and IEEE, you'll find some very interesting material. So right now we've got three questions lined up. Bob, Joe, and Doug, in that order. Bob. Bob first, W2OSR. Go right ahead, Bob.
Okay, Dick, W2OSR. I read your article about antenna matching. Played around with it a little bit to my little teeny Yagi, and it looks like with the setup I've got, lengthening the driven element a bit and putting about 5.6 picofarads of capacitance across the feed point, should get everything to work right.
You could use a little bit more audio, Bob, but you sound nice and clear. And yes, you're reconfirming for the zillionth time the fact that you can get any impedance you want out of a dipole-like structure by doing nothing but adjusting the length until you get the right resistive component, and then whatever reactive component is left over, you can most of the time get rid of it by putting a shunt capacitor right across the feed point. So with your antenna modeling, you seem to have reproven that. That's a good sign. And how soon will you actually be converting that into real physical pieces of metal that are going to be machined with your hands? Over to you, Robert.
Well, the pieces of metal are pretty well machined. I've got to adjust the spacing on a couple of elements. Of course, it's going to look unconventional because that driven element is going to be longer than anything else on the antenna, including the reflector. Howsomever, the modeling says it should work, so we'll give it a shot. And as soon as Ocean State Electronics delivers my capacitors, I'll be ready to take a go at it.
Let me ask you this, Bob. Were you able to confirm with your EasyNeck, I think it was, 3.0, that as you made the driven element longer, you got exactly the impedance match you wanted, but there was essentially no change in the gain, directivity pattern, or whatever, of the Yagi while you made that driven element longer than the reflector? And as I've mentioned in the article, there's an amazing number of very smart VHF, UHF, ham radio operators who for years and years have been told that a Yagi will only work if the reflector is longer than the driven element. And if for impedance matching purposes you make the driven element longer, they think the antenna is going to explode, they think it's going to stop working, and they refuse to go there, even though all their measurements tell them it's working hunky-dory. Did EasyNeck told you that the directivity pattern didn't change when you did that? I wonder if you had that confirmation, Bob. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Dick, making those adjustments have very little effect on the antenna in terms of its performance. Free space gain stayed pretty well around 11 dB. The predicted gain at about 20 meters above the ground is about 17 dB. You know the ground effect is helping the antenna out a bit. Over.
Understand. Okay. Okay, let's go over to Joe now, to B2RYY. What have you heard tonight that has made you suddenly have a question, Joe? K2RIW listening.
Well, I try checking in early, but I keep on getting stepped on from checking in from the internet. That's a problem. I have a question about a DC power supply I'm using. I don't know what piece of equipment. It's actually a pair of DC supplies that I used in series to deliver normally about 660, 670 volts to the transmitter. Normally that's the DC voltage that I've been getting on a couple of these power supplies, but on one in particular one, the DC voltage output goes down about 580 or so, and it's got more drop on the higher section than normal. And it's hard to find what, across what section it seems to be dropping. The secondary voltages on the transformer seem to be identical or very similar to the other supplies that are working correctly. And the diodes seem to be, you know, correctly as far as, you know, them working properly. The chokes have the same resistance on them, on the volt supplies from one to the other. So it's hard for me to determine where the voltage is being dropped for these things. Any idea on something like this?
Yeah, when you put power supplies in series on the secondary, in other words, I presume both of your power supplies are running with a transformer from what I'm hearing. Maybe they're switching type and maybe they're all ordinary 60 cycle type. It almost doesn't matter. And the primary side, of course, is near earth potential. But the secondary side, one of them is probably grounded on the negative. The positive lead of one goes to the negative of the other. So one of those power supplies is floating with high voltage on the secondary winding of that transformer. And the transformer might very well not be rated for that service. So when you design a transformer, you're designing a certain dielectric strength between the secondary winding and the core of the transformer, which usually is grounded. So you're floating the secondary winding, but you're putting a lot higher voltage, and some internal arcing and corona discharge may be taking place on that higher voltage transformer, because maybe it is not rated for that particular service. So putting power supplies in series, even though they are rated as floating, is obviously a common mode DC offset voltage maximum that should not be exceeded. And there's a slim chance you've exceeded that. So by various testing techniques, by putting a sensitive receiver nearby, you may be able to detect the corona discharge, because it's going to be making radio noise if that's what's happening there, Joe. Maybe that's the explanation for where the higher voltage might be disappearing. It's a pure guess on my part. It gives you at least one more thing to test for. W2RYY, K2RYW on the TechNet.
Okay, wouldn't that pull the secondary voltage down appreciably between one supply and another? I said that the secondary voltage on the output of the transformer on both sections is similar. It drops about 15 volts under load.
Okay, I presume, you didn't say it, but I presume you're using a floating volt-ohm milliammeter or a digital voltmeter. You're putting it directly across the secondary winding of the one that's floating with high DC voltage on it. You back away from the thing, make sure that it's on a nice insulated stand, and then turn everything on and you're confirming the right voltage. So if I understand you correctly, the secondary winding of the one with the extra high voltage is giving you the right voltage, yet the output voltage of that supply, the DC filtered voltage, you seem to be saying is lower. How are you confirming that? How much lower than the one that is not floating, even though there are supposedly identical supplies? And I presume these are either 60-cycle type supplies or switching regulators. You might tell me that one, too. There's a lot of missing information here, Joe. Over to you, Joe.
What else do you want for information? I'll tell you. They're both operating on 60-cycle. They're not regulated at all. Simple bridge rectifier on both power supply sections. One has about 270 volts across the secondary, and the other one has about 350 across the secondary. And on transmit, they're added together. The both bridges are added together, and the final voltage should be at normally about 660 volts. Unloaded, they're both about 800, almost 800 volts unloaded. But one drops down about 590 on transmit instead of about 660. That's the problem I'm having. I'm trying to identify what part of the supply seems to be indicating more of a loss across the thing. The bulb chokes in series with the bridge rectifier on both supplies. It's got give me a moment to look at the schematic. But both chokes measure the same resistance between one supply to another, and they're very close to what the book says is what they're supposed to be, but the resultant output DC voltage of one supply is goes down about 590, 585 instead of 660. And that's where I'm trying to isolate the problem of where it's dropping across. And it's very hard to... it seems like it's a very simple problem, but it's going somewhere, and I can't really identify where it's going.
I got a comment on this. This is K2KEY.
Yeah, I got a much more burning question here. If the two supplies are essentially identical, why is one secondary winding giving you quite a bit more AC voltage than the other secondary winding? Now, that ain't clear, Joe. Go ahead.
Probably because you're not understanding what I'm telling you. The secondary voltage, the book calls for the secondary voltage being 270 on one section and about 360 on the other section. That's across the transformer itself, all right? Right out of the transformer, feeding the bridge rectifier. Both power supplies drop down about 15 volts on transmit from load, say load to no load, okay? So both transformers seem to give me the same output, the output AC voltage was measured the same kind of meter. Okay, you understand that so far?
No, I do not. The first time you told me the secondary winding of one power supply was X voltage, and the secondary winding of the other power supply was Y voltage, and those two voltages differed a lot. Two transmissions below, you said those words, and you confused me. Over to you, Joe.
I'm not trying to confuse you. This is a commercial supply used on a particular a piece of radio equipment. It's an old, very old power supply. It's a commercial design. It's not something I threw together or designed. So it was designed correctly. Something happened to it, and it's not working correctly. Both supplies use a single power transformer, not multiple power transformers. It's got multiple windings on one transformer. Both supplies will give me the same drop on the secondary voltages on each section, feeding the bridge rectifiers. The book calls for 270 on one winding and 360 on the other winding. Both windings drop down 15 volts VAC between load and no load. Do you follow that so far?
Okay, you've got two secondary windings, is what you seem to be telling me. A 270 and a 360. Are those two windings used in series, making a total of 630 open circuit? And is the 630 voltage, is that what's being fed to the bridge rectifier? Over to you, Joe.
They're putting the supplies in series. They're putting them in series with the DC outputs of the bridge rectifiers. In other words, the one bridge rectifier on the minus side, it has a fuse and a small, very small ohmic resistor. Like, I think the lower voltage section is like a 3.3 ohm resistor. It has a fuse that's on the bottom leg of the bridge. The top leg of the bridge that has a DC output, of course, that's where your choke is attached. In fact, I think it's, let me look at the schematic for a minute, because I think it's a cap, choke, cap type of construction of both supplies. But that's the basic design of what this thing is. The DC voltages are added together, not the AC voltages.
Okay. I think you're telling me there are two separate bridge rectifiers going into two separate filter networks, giving you two DC voltages that you're using essentially in series. Is each bridge rectifier seeing essentially the same amount of AC voltage? If not, why not? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, I said that already. I measured the secondary output voltage of each transformer feeding the bridge, and it drops about 15 volts, what the book says. That's what's a little puzzling. The diodes all seem to check out okay, but yet the resultant DC output out of the higher voltage section. I mean, let me talk about the lower one. The lower one, in its idle state, it'll give you about 350 volts DC, and the higher one is about 440 DC. Now, the minus side of the 440 power supply, that DC is attached to a relay to the plus side of the 300-volt supply below it, 350-volt supply on transmit. That's how they're added together. On the On the working supply, the voltage will drop from 440 down to about 360. The lower voltage section drops from 350, something like that, down to about 305. So on the broken supply, the lower DC voltage seems to be similar under load, but on the higher voltage section is dropping substantially more. Instead of going down to 360, it drops down to about 280. From 440 unloaded, it gives me a reading about 280 loaded.
Okay, you said the 440 goes down to 360, then you told me it goes down to 280. Whereas the 350 goes down to 305. Why are the two different drop numbers for the 440? 440 unloaded, 360 under some condition, 280 under another condition. What are those two conditions, Joe?
Measuring a broken supply and a not broken supply.
Okay. Tell me how many AC volts goes into bridge rectifier number one. How many AC volts is going into bridge rectifier number two?
On both power supplies, unloaded, the lower voltage winding of the transformer is supposed to be nominally, it's maybe slightly less than 270 unloaded. Maybe it's 265 or something like that, all right? So it's close to 270, you know, not that far away from it. Same thing with the other section. One section calls for 270 VAC feeding the bridge. The other section of the higher voltage winding, that calls for about 360 VAC feeding the bridge. They both drop about 15 volts under load on both supplies, the working supply and the non-working supply. So that seemed to tell me that the transformer was not the culprit in the equation of what I'm looking for as the answer to this thing.
Okay, Mel said he's got some opinions. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Well, I had a similar experience. Let me tell you what I did. Now, he explained to me basically the same situation. And I'll tell you the explanation I got. Way back, now, it was a time I was young, I was going to Brooklyn Tech. And I built a rig with a power supply, a 750-volt power supply, that would supply, that easily loaded could easily load 300, 400 milliamps, worked perfect. And so I got this clever idea that I'm going to go to higher power. I went ahead and I got myself another transformer. I was able to get those transformers very cheap. I didn't have the resources to buy one power transformer. I figured, why can't I put three of these 750-volt transformers in series, the secondaries by, of course, correctly getting the correct polarity, and then put it into a rectifier and wind up with, say, 2,000 volts of B-plus at, say, at least somewhere around 400-500 mils. I could not get that to work, Dick. Tell me why.
Once again, how many volts out of each supply, how many were you putting in series, and where was the primary power coming from for these power supplies, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, they are 110-volt transformers. I took, they were individual, individually started out. The power transformers were individual at the time. I built the power supply for one rig, you know, using common 750 volts, which was popular in those days to run a pair of finals. And I decided, well, why not? I built one of these supplies, and it works really well. I built another supply, hooked it to the rig, it worked well. I built a third supply, it worked well. Why can't I put these supplies together and come up with 750 volts times 3 over?
Okay. I presume you had three separate power transformers, each being fed 115 volts on the primary. High voltage-wise, the primary is essentially grounded, and the core of the transformer is essentially grounded. Secondary winding is a winding that, after rectification, gave you 750 volts DC. But when you put those secondary voltages, the 750s, in series, you are now taking the winding of the second power supply and certainly the third power supply, and the secondary winding is now sitting either 750 or 1600 volts above ground, and you're putting a hell of a lot more DC voltage on that secondary winding. And the transformer was not rated for that service. A guy who designs a transformer, he's between a rock and a hard place. He doesn't have enough air core space in his EI laminations. He doesn't have enough space for the winding to make a real thick insulation. So he's got a compromise going on. He can either make a thick insulation, and now he doesn't have enough area left over for all the turns of wire, and that forces him into a small gauge of wire, which gives him a lot of resistance in the secondary winding. Or conversely, he can put in a very thin layer of insulation. Now he can use the same number of turns with a thicker wire, but now the transformer is going to arc over sooner. So I think you see where I'm going here, that you were stressing those secondary windings of those transformers in a way that was different than the way that transformer was designed. I wonder if that makes sense so far, Ramel. And by the way, you said it didn't work. When it didn't work, does that mean you didn't get 3 times 750? You got some much lower number, and you're enough of a scientist that I'm sure you put the ground lead of the VOM on the negative lead of 1, and then you touched each one of the higher voltages to find out what voltage you were getting out of each one of the power supplies in series. What numbers did you see? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Okay, well, these were 3 surplus transformers, and they were marked very clearly on a 10,000 volt insulation, breakdown insulation. If you remember those transformers that were made for World War II equipment, they were, let's put it this way, humongous for their for what they were producing. They were way, you know, had to be way over the specifications that would normally be needed. So I went ahead, like I say, 3 identical transformers, number-wise, everything. They looked the same. I mean, there was no difference in them. Yet when I put them together and put it through the rectifiers, as soon as I went to load this thing down, you know, tune it up, the voltages just dropped equilateral across the 3 of them. I was trying every which way to measure with little I had. I had just a basic VOM. But I could see that there was some kind of a strange voltage drop. In other words, I expected to see at least 2,000 volts. And all, I think it dropped down to something like 950, 975, some strange amount. And I was not loading it more in current-wise than I did on the when I used them individually, Dick. Over.
Yeah, did you really make 3 completely independent 750-volt power supplies and then hook the output wires, the DC wires, together? Or did you just take the secondary 3 windings of the 3 transformers, put the windings in series into 1 high-voltage bridge rectifier? Which did you do, Mel? Go ahead.
Now I got frustrated. I tried it all kinds. First I started out, I figured, aha, I'll make a nice, neat power supply, like you say. Just put the 3 transformers on one chassis, put the 3 secondary windings in series to add up to about 2,100 volts or so, and then put it into, at that time, I used a bridge circuit using, of course, 866s. I mean, I guess it's all surplus, you know, stuff I got for nothing, literally. And for some reason, I tried all kinds of configurations. I finally gave up, and I took the problem to Brooklyn Tech, to an electrical teacher that taught electrical engineering in Brooklyn Tech, and I tell you, he gave me an answer that I still scratch my head over.
Yeah, I'm a little bit afraid to find out. What was the current rating of each of the individual power supplies, and what current were you drawing out of the composite of the 3 of them, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, when I built the individual power supply, I didn't have the exact specifications on these transformers as to how much current they can really produce, other than, well, you know, I knew they were surplus transformers. They had some specs on the transformer, you know, color coding, wiring, and some other things like 10,000 volt insulation. They had that khaki color. You remember those transformers? They were filled with God knows what. They most likely could kill you what the chemicals were in them today. I built the 1 power supply initially using one of these transformers, and into that time just a pair of 5R4s. That was the original version of it. and I ran it into, and I ran a pair of, I think it was 807s. Yes, must have been, I think it was 807s. And 750 volts on a plate, and I loaded it up to about, 350, 400 mils. I used to drive them, you know, until like, you know, squeezing them every which way, getting the tubes were 25 cents a piece, until the plates glowed red in them. Then I knew, aha, now I'm putting out power. And I remember going to 350, 400 milliamps, Dick, and it worked. And I said, aha, why can't I build something bigger with this? Didn't work out for some reason, over.
Okay, so each individual power supply produced 750 volts, I presume lightly loaded, and then with 300 milliamps or so of loading where the plates of your transmitting tube were glowing, it dropped down to, did you get a chance to measure what voltage the power supply, a single power supply would drop down to when those plates were glowing and melt? And the plates that were glowing had to be a transmitting tube. A 5R4GY is a rectifier, I think. You weren't making the plates of the rectifier glow, were you? Go ahead.
Oh, they were the far rectifiers before I went to 866s. That's a low. At 750 volts, you can use 5R4s. They were the, the popular rectifiers of World War II for up to, I think they rated up to about 900 volts. The drop was very, that power supply, they were, with the swinging choke in there and the filters, all those surplus parts, those oil-filled caps and everything. The voltage drop wasn't that great. I bleeded it. The bleeder was a good hefty 50 watts of bleeder resistor in there, so that the swing on the power supply was fairly minimum, Dick. And judging by the size of those transformers, I could easily see God knows what you could take out of them. I would bet you could most likely gone double the current out of them. But the physical weight of those transformers, these were power transformers that you looked at and you'd say, they definitely need to use in a kilowatt rig, over.
Okay, let's go slow now. You started off with 5R4GY dual diode rectifiers on the 750 volt power supply. You could draw 300 and some odd milliamps into your transmitting tube, whatever that was, 807s, I think you said. And you could make the plate of an 807, a 25 watt dissipation tube, glow. And so you were putting out some real steam. Now when you hook the three power supplies together, if there were three independent supplies, and they've all got grounded transformers, grounded swinging chokes, maybe oil-filled capacitors, maybe not oil-filled capacitors, but if they were oil-filled capacitors, the capacitors are connected to a chassis. I am guessing your three individual chassis were grounded, even though you asked for two of the power supplies to be floating in higher voltage output DC-wise. So your swinging chokes, oil-filled capacitors being grounded, were the three chassis being grounded, even though the secondary DC voltages were being used in series? Give me a couple of words on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, I didn't build three power supplies. I built one power supply initially with the 5R4s. When I went to go to this higher voltage contraption, I used the three transformers and then one rectifier system. That's when I went to the 866s, because I visualized that if I built three identical power supplies, and like you say, the middle one would have had this high potential on it and blown this the rectifier. The 5R4s would never have handled it. They would have arced over instantly. So I decided, I said, why can't I make myself a setup here just using three of these transformers, which I had a whole pile of them. I must have had at least a dozen of them around. And I'll take three as identical transformers, put them on 110 volts primary, take the secondaries, get it so set up so that each one added, that, they didn't buck one another, the secondaries, and then put it into a rectifier system and wind up with 2,000 volts thick. Why wouldn't this work, over?
Okay, your bridge rectifier output, I think it was a bridge, either it was a full wave, was 866's mercury vapor type. And the nice thing about a mercury vapor tube is it glows blue, and you can tell by the amount of current flowing through it how much blue glow you're getting. With a two or four of the 866s, and they have something like 2.5 volt filament windings, and those windings on the filament have to be high voltage. How did you make that bridge rectifier, if it was, out of 866s? Give us a few description words on that. That went into a capacitor choke, capacitor rectifier, swinging choke type. Maybe it was a Pi, maybe it was a choke input. And then were the output filter capacitors at 2,500 volts, most likely they're oil filled and grounded to the chassis. Give us a few words on that description of that supply, Mel, go ahead.
Okay, so the four mercury rectifiers, that'd be like four diodes. Applied the AC to it, just like you would do with solid-state rectifiers today. Came off the transformer. Yes, the filament transformer, of course, had to be a high current, which, of course, that was another humongous thing. I mean, this was a power supply that you wouldn't lift up so easy. And it was rated at 2.5 volts at about, 25 amps, I would think, that something like that. It was heavy wiring coming out of it. I could say all surplus. And then that went into my first filter, and then a swinging choke, and then another filter. It was the conventional design. In other words, I looked at a conventional design power supply that they showed in all the magazines then, what was usually built with one power transformer. And I visualized, I said, why can't you take three of them, put them together, and wind up with the same thing, because I couldn't afford to buy one transformer. One plate transformer. Why can't I make it? Why can't you just keep hooking transformers up here as long as they have the breakdown, the insulation doesn't break down in there, and build a power supply under those auspices, in other words, Dick. Why wouldn't that work, over?
Okay, I've got a couple of crazy questions here. The filament winding for the 866 mercury vapor tubes, I think it's around 2.5 volts, at something like a couple of amperes. How many completely separate 2.5 volt filament windings fed the filaments of those four 866 tubes? How many separate windings fed those filaments of those four tubes? Back to you, Mel.
Four. There were four windings on this transformer for the filament. This was a conventional early bird. They did go to bridge. The reason they went to a bridge rectifier system during World War II was, I remember they had a reason that was certain equipment. Oh, yes, I remember. They actually designed a transmitter to be put aboard the B-29 that was a kilowatt transmitter stick, and it was fed by a separate, nobody really knew that, there was a fifth engine, believe it or not, in the B-29 that sat in the rear that ran only the electrical equipment. The four engines that drove the plane had nothing to do with the electrical equipment on the plane. The fifth engine was for everything. So they were driving this setup with this fifth engine and had a conventional 110 volt AC system, which I really was marveled. Because I expected they would have, used 400 cycles like they did in most of their other systems. But here they had 110 volt AC, Dick, running the fifth engine, just running a generator, over.
Wow. Now, when I draw myself a bridge rectifier made out of 866 tubes, two of those cathodes are connected together on two of the tubes, so they can share a winding. In theory, you only need three windings to do that. But you had four windings going to the four separate tubes. Two of those cathodes are together, and two of those anodes are together. Two of the anodes are together going to ground. Two of the cathodes are together going to the DC output on that bridge rectifier. Does that sound about right, Mel? Go ahead.
It was, I think, conventional, like you would say, that the two cathodes that come together would wind up going to, you would, equivalent of the chassis ground, like you said, and then the two cathodes that came together went to the first filter stage. Conventional diode type arrangement, over.
Okay. Did you, with light loading, and by the way, was there one composite bleeder resistor on this power supply? And was it somewhat similar to the previous bleeder resistor in current rating? Did you get something like 2200 volts DC unloaded? And if normal loading of individual supplies was 350 milliamps, what load do you think you were putting on the supply when it dropped down to some, you know, 900 volts like thing? What load in milliamps? And what tube were you feeding? You used to feed something like a 1625 or a 866 tube. What was the tube that was supposed to run on the 2000 volts? Was that an 813 or a pair of 813? Over to you, Mel.
Well, I started out with I was going to build a pair of 813s, right? But I said, okay, let me just see if I can get one to go. Then I could always, you know, add on another one because, again, this was all surplus that I was literally getting for nothing. So I was had a cotton load of 813s and all. So it was to feed an 813. I hooked it up. I lightly loaded it. And nothing just dropped right down on me. I said, what the heck? Maybe the tube is bad. Maybe I did this wrong. Maybe I did that wrong. I tried every kind of medium and could not get it to work, the power supply. I just gave up with it, Dick. And after a while, I tried all kinds of craziness with this. Why I didn't electrocute myself with it, that's another thing. But I could not get this thing to work. And I got a half an answer from a teacher in school over.
Yeah, I'm eventually going to ask you that one. I want to hold off on that one, though, because I know it's going to be a crazy answer. What do you believe was the unloaded voltage? I know that the loaded voltage jumped down to like 900. Was the unloaded voltage close to 2,000? What's your guess as to the amount of loading? Did you have the ability to see the current flowing into the 813? And did you then get a chance to put your volt-ohm-milliammeter in the AC scale across the individual transformer secondary windings? Be very interesting to find out what individual winding voltages were as you started loading it. Back to you, Mel.
I got to recall that a lot of this, of course, 50 years ago, or more than 50 years ago. What did I do? Oh, yes, I put the, I looked at the milliamp meter that was on there. And if I'm not mistaken, as soon as I started to load this thing, maybe it got up to like 50 mils, it just stopped. I said, what in the heck is going on here? Well, I'm going to tell you something. The rig itself, let's put it this way. The rig itself, I started blaming all kinds of things on the rig. And I finally cajoled one guy, I'll never forget, that had a... built a kilowatt rig with 813s, and I told him my problem and all, and I cajoled him into letting me bring over just the final section, which he hooked up to his power supply, and the goddamn thing worked perfect. So I went back again. I said, what am I doing wrong? And I could never get the answer to this thing. I don't remember if I really measured the primaries at the time, but I just remembered that it just sunk the thing. I guess I eventually just abandoned it, Dick, over.
Did you get a chance to measure the AC ripple coming out of that supply, Mel? What happens if your filter capacitors were one-tenth of the microfarads you thought they were? And were the filter capacitors a series parallel arrangement of capacitors, or were they great big 2,500-volt oil-filled capacitors grounded? What was your filter output network like, Mel? And did you get a chance to measure the AC ripple? Go ahead.
I used the same components that I used in the individual supplies. Believe it or not, these filters were, let me remember now, 16 mic, 5,000 volt oil-filled capacitor stick. I had quite a number of them. And how did I test them? I charge them and stick a screwdriver across them over.
Oh, that's a very good test. And all of us with oil-filled capacitors had a lot of fun putting them across, a screwdriver across them, and taking a chunk out of the screwdriver and seeing that great big loud pop and blue flame and whatever, and the sparks. And that's a fun thing to do. With ozone, you smell afterwards. It's amazing if the oil-filled capacitors don't explode when you do that, don't boil inside. I remember shorting them out multiple times on one particular day like that, just for the fun of it. So you don't remember putting the floating volt ohm milliammeter, your triplet or Simpson 630, a triplet, can't remember the model numbers now. Anyhow, triplet or Simpson, you don't remember putting it across the individual transformer secondaries. That would have been fun. To look at the DC voltage coming out of the bridge rectifier before the swinging choke, that would have been fun. Measure the AC ripple there, that would have been fun. So you had these great big oil-filled capacitors, and if it was the exact same number of microfarads on the 750-volt supply versus the 2200-volt supply, that's more than enough microfarads. How many microfarads were on the input end of the swinging choke right after the bridge rectifier mill? If you happen to remember, go ahead.
Roger. Well, remember, this was surplus. There was 16 mics right after the rectifier. Going after the swinging choke, another 16 mics. That was the, you know, common design in a bleeder resistor you could stick on the end there. Now remember, Dick, wait a minute. Let's just talk about instruments. I did not own an oscilloscope. I did not own a Simpson 260. That came years later. I had my meter. Let me tell you what my meter consists of. I had a 0 to 1 milliamp meter, and on a breadboard, I had resistors with Fahnestocks, and you just tapped. In other words, you put under the Fahnestock the appropriate resistor, and I had some half-brained way I calibrated all this stuff. And with batteries and all, I made myself an ohm meter with this and all. I had no way to measure capacitance and all. And my half-brained way I was measuring anything, DC volts and everything, was with this so-called homebrew VOM that, you know, they used to describe in the amateur radio handbook, you know, the simple instrument. I mean, this was my only instrument, really, to speak of, over.
Yeah, 1 milliamp meter gives you 1,000 ohms per volt, whereas the triplet would have been 20,000 ohms per volt. You had a fairly low impedance voltmeter. But for that kind of a power supply, that's adequate. And to measure AC voltage, yeah, you'd need the AC scale of a triplet or a Simpson. Huh, but you didn't have one of those. Did the four 866s with their blue glow, did they glow equally? Is question number one. Did you see a change in their glow when you loaded this power supply? What did you see with the 866s? There's another clue there, Ramel. Go ahead.
Good, it's K2KEY. When I initially put it on the 866s, I saw them come alive, like you say, in a nice, beautiful glow. And as soon as I had to load this thing down, they stalled out. That was it. They were gone. They went out, and that was it. I thought for sure this rig short this thing out or something. I was looking and everything. I figured, why does the milliamp need a pin then, because the 866s are going out. Don't know. Didn't. That was it. They just, as soon as you started to draw a current off this thing, it just dropped dead, over.
Okay, run that by again now. When you first turned on the power supply, you saw the bright blue glow of all four 866s as they're charging up the capacitors. With the power supply unloaded, my guess is there's only a very light blue glow. You started loading the supply, and the blue glow of the 866s disappeared. Is that what you said, Mel? Very strong clue. Go ahead.
Exactly. Just went out, and that was it. That's why the power supply went down. Once the 866s dropped, you know, the voltage dropped on them that sufficiently, they just become no rectifiers, really. I don't think at 866, I don't think I remember what their ratings are, what point the 866 became an inoperative rectifier. In other words, you never saw an 866 used, say, for a power supply, 500-600-700-volt power supply. Never saw them used in that type of setup. So I don't think they would be effective for the mercury rectifiers at lower voltages, over.
When that tube is rectifying, I think there's less than 50 volts drop across it because of the mercury vapor. And you could definitely use them way down toward the 300-volt supplies. I've done it. My first 1625 or 807-type transmitter used 866s, and they would glow beautifully on a 750-volt power supply. The fact that they went out, the only way they can go out is that you're supplying them no voltage